Let's stand this morning for the reading of God's Word. We're going to be in 2 Corinthians. Is this 27? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. This is number 27. And disclosing a depressed saint. Now, we have left off of the depressed part for a while. The first, if I didn't get him, he'd be bugging me. The first many weeks, beginning in chapter 1 of this book, we saw Paul's state of mind, his heightened anxieties and depressions and fears, and he's left off of that, and we started really kind of a new line of thought last week, and we will continue this for the next two chapters, chapters 8 and 9, which are all about Christian giving. And I can be very nostalgic as I say that, because I can remember thinking not too long ago, but for a long time, my Christian life, that the idea of coming into church and hearing not just one, but several sermons on Christian giving would have created some emotions in me, most of which I would not have been proud to share. I'm thinking that you might be like me in that respect, so I want you to know, as I said last week, these series of messages will absolutely, I hope I remember to say this every time, have nothing to do at all with me hoping to guilt or fear you into giving, but will have everything to do with hoping to guilt and fear you into not introspecting, not looking inside, and we'll talk about that more in here just a second. So all these sermons on giving, I absolutely do not want you to give guiltily. That would be sin, you just heaping wrath upon yourself. And just a little discussion with Sister Vicky this morning, it's saying about going to church. If so-called Christians have to be drugged to church, they're probably not Christian. Okay, so if you have to be guilted or feared or shamed into coming to church, there's something wrong with your want to. And that's the more important issue, whether you come to church or not. No, it's the more important issue is where your want to is. So Paul has used, we saw last week, the example of the Macedonians to inspire the Corinthians. And we're going to review that this morning now with these verses. We're going back to verse 1 through verse 8 this morning. We want you to know, brothers, about the grace of God that has been given among the churches of Macedonia. For in a severe test of affliction, their abundance of joy and their extreme poverty have overflowed in a wealth of generosity on their part. For they gave according to their means, as I can testify, and beyond their means, of their own accord, begging us earnestly for the favor of taking part in the relief of the saints. And this, not as we expected, but they gave themselves first to the Lord, and then by the will of God to us. Accordingly, we urged Titus that as he had started, so he should complete among you this act of grace. But as you excel in everything, in faith, in speech, in knowledge, in all earnestness, and in our love for you, see that you excel in this act of grace also. I say this not as a command, but to prove by the earnestness of others that your love also is genuine. May God bless the reading of his word. You can be seated. So Paul has brought the Macedonians into his appeal to the Corinthians to inspire them to demonstrate their love for God as being genuine by proving that this grace is working in their lives. I've studied this past week, this message, the word that we brought from these verses last week has been even more surely confirmed. Last week, I hope you remember, there are two areas of giving that we talked about that And especially, at least, we Christians who live in the prosperous West, that we should concern ourselves with two kinds of giving. And the first is the responsible contribution to the operation of the local community or the local church. Now, that's usually called tithes. And we saw last week, and I hope, and we'll say this as long as the Lord gives us breath, there is no New Testament teaching about tithing. Okay, and we've pointed out one of the reasons is because the New Testament teaches how much of yourself you should give. Right, all, 100%. You give everything. That's what it is. So the New Testament puts no restriction at all anywhere and says, hit the 10% mark and then you can feel good about yourself. If that is in you, get it out of you. Cast it out like a demon because it's wickedness. If we have a target and say, okay, I'm gonna relieve myself of some anxiety and some guilt or something of that nature, if I can hit this mark of financial giving, that's coming from some place in the flesh. That's not coming from the Spirit. So there are two realms of giving that we as Christians should be concerned. The first is being responsible in helping take care of what we have here, right? Who all is responsible for the mortgage payment of this church? Okay? If you're a covenant member, you're responsible, okay? Every covenant member has a responsibility to help pay the mortgage, pay the electric, and pay the water. By the great blessing of God, you do not pay your preacher, okay? The Lord's been kind and gracious to us to relieve the church. But you know, if I hadn't worked, y'all supposed to pay me too. Okay? everybody's starting to sweat now, aren't they? That is not generosity. Okay? That is not generosity. You can mark you put it as tithe, and that's fine. And if it's 10%, that's fine. And if it's 20 or whatever it is, that's fine. But that's not generosity, okay? That's you paying your bills, all right? And to think, well, the church and my obligations there are separate from everything. Well, you're just fooling yourself, okay? The Moose requires dues. The Elks, the BPOE, you know, I don't care what kind of group you're in. Okay? They got dues for homemakers? Do they? Okay. So in that sense, there's really nothing particularly Christian about that. Do you all understand? That the people who come together to worship here, and this is their home, that they take care of the bills, there's nothing particularly Christian about that. You know, and I'm cutting my foot off here. I know that as I say this, you can come up with lots of reasons not to want to take care of these things, and I hope you don't, but, you know what happens if we don't pay the mortgage, okay, you know, so there's that one area of giving has nothing to do with chapters 8 and 9 that we're reading here, okay, it's the other kind of giving that Paul is using here, and as I studied this past week, I listened to John MacArthur in a couple of messages, and he so well brought this back to the, mainly to the Old Testament, because what Paul is talking about here is what has, in lots of circles, become known as free will offerings. Okay, free will. In the Old Testament, they're actually called that. Those are offerings that are given not as a sense of responsibility, not because you have to take care of someone's salary or take care of the mortgage or the electric, but they're given out of a flow of generosity that happens in the heart. Okay, and that's what chapters 8 and 9. So please get this. All that we're going to teach about this on these two chapters, if God works a grace in you and you start doing this, how much of this local community is going to benefit from your free will offering? How much, what percentage of your free will offering will stay here? Anybody got a clue? Zero. Zero. If you mark an offering for the missions, every penny goes to missions. If you mark an offering for the orphanage in Africa, every penny goes to the orphanage in Africa. So while I'm going to preach these number of weeks on this, get this, understand this. If the Lord moves on you to for this grace to work in your life, we won't get anything from it here. We won't get a dime. It won't go towards the mortgage. It won't go towards the lights. It won't go toward the water. It won't go to anything. It'll except to those places, the relief. That's what these two chapters are about. So I hope everybody's clear on that, because preachers love to be accused to talk about money in order to fatten the reservoir. Either their own or the church's. Not going to happen. Okay. On the same token, if God doesn't move on you, we won't be taking from the responsible giving to do that. Okay, so both kinds of giving are very important, but you need to understand that the one that we're talking about, there's no local benefit. I want you to think about how selfish that would be as a people. If we said, okay, we're gonna raise more money to send to our foreign missionaries, and we brought in a lot of money for that, and we said, well, we'll just keep 10% of that to help defray costs or whatever, because that's the excuse that people use to keep back on charities. Well, I can't think of anything more selfish as a group to do something like that. Those two areas we covered last week. Paul is mainly, and this free will offering, this free will giving is what Paul is mainly teaching about here, and it's for relief, and he says it is a proof of grace at work in a professing Christian's life. It is a proof of grace, and that's really where I want our attention to go. I gave you a warning about this is not provoking giving so that we get material support, but it is about provoking giving for relief, and that can only be a grace if it flows from a joyous heart, if it flows from a generous heart. It has to be a work of grace, so it requires introspection. As I was talking to Brian yesterday morning, having breakfast with him, and he's going to preach for us 2 weeks from today. Now, we'll be back by then, the Lord willing, by his grace and mercy. We won't have service next week, but 2 weeks from today, Brian's going to come in and bring the word. Having a breakfast with him and talking about these things, and he pointed out that there's such a fine line, because churches have and preachers have a strong reputation of guilting people into giving or fearing them into giving, trying to produce either guilt or fear in order to increase giving. And if that were to be the case, so Brian said, so what happens if next week there's 100% participation in relief giving? That in the offering, that there is 100, for the families that are here, there's 100% participation in sending either the missionaries or the orphanage. What about that? He said, he's pointing out there's a danger about that, because people may be doing that out of guilt or fear, which would be a curse. Okay? It would be something that God would be displeased with, to give out of guilt or fear. And he said, but how would anybody know the difference? So if we had 100%, it's a good provoking question. I thought, well, that means that either everybody prayed and God revealed grace in their lives. Everybody introspected and felt a joyousness about participating in this kind of giving, or people felt guilty or afraid to not give, and so they did. How can I help you not do that second thing? So, because he kind of grinned at me, he says, so there, in a sense, you hope there's no more in there tomorrow. I said, yeah. because I don't want anybody to do that out of guilt or fear. But if there has been a grace revealed that has provoked generosity and love, I think that'd be something to testify about. Okay? So it was a good discussion. So guilt and fear giving will not remedy relief giving. It must flow from received grace and why we have to introspect. So let's get to our text. Remember the Macedonians that Paul has told us that they, it was out of a severe trial of affliction. They, you know, that they were either sick or persecuted. We're not sure which. They had this abundant joy, even though they were extremely poor, and these things worked together to produce a wealth of generosity. Okay, so what you've got is a turnip in Macedonia, and you're getting blood out of it. All right? That's what's happening. There's no reason why there should be anything coming out of Macedonia. They're sick and persecuted. They are extremely poor. And yet there is this generosity that doesn't necessarily mean that they're sending a lot of money or resources. It just means that God has just given them generous hearts to give what they don't have to give. And he's put that forth as the example for the Corinthians. Remember that they gave according to their means, the Macedonians. Not only do they give according to their means, but beyond their means and of their own accord, voluntarily. And first they gave themselves, and he puts that example before the Corinthians, and then he turns to the Corinthians and say, let's talk about you for a second. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to turn to the Corinthians. And the first thing I want you to understand is that there are very different circumstances between the Macedonian churches and the Corinthian church. I wish I had a good map. If you could envision this landmass as an hourglass, okay? And at the top of the hourglass would be Philippi, Thessalonica, and Berea, all places where Paul established churches. At the top of the hourglass, that's Macedonia. At the bottom of the hourglass would be Greece. And right there in the little skinny part between the top part and the bottom part, y'all know what I'm talking about, where the sand goes through, you know, that little narrow piece of glass, that's where Corinth is. All right? And great big masses of water on either side. So you got these poor in the north part of that hourglass. You've got these three congregations. You have Philippi, Thessalonica, and Berea. We don't know where Paul is. He's probably at Philippi as he writes this letter, but he could be at Thessalonica or Berea. And we know something about those churches. We know something about what they've gone through to even exist. And then you have down there in that little narrow spot. You have Corinth. We know that when Paul first showed up in Macedonia a few years ago, he went to Philippi first, and we know that he met a strong civil resistance there. He and Silas were arrested, and most people, well, we sang the little song today, right? In prisoners' chains, you know, they got beat at midnight. What were they doing? Singing and praising the Lord, and then what happened? Yeah, the earthquake, the chains, and the jailer. So the strong civil resistance to the gospel in Philippi. And, of course, they get released, and the civil authorities, and there's not a real strong Jewish community there because there's not a synagogue. Paul and Silas, they went to the riverbank where some of the women prayed, some of the devout women would pray because there was not enough Jews for there to be a synagogue. They go to Thessalonica next, and there's a stronger Jewish presence there. There's a synagogue, and they end up being strongly resisted by the Jewish community in Thessalonica and then in Berea. In fact, in Thessalonica, the apostles are so mistreated that they have to escape from Thessalonica, and they go to Berea, and they find the people a little bit more accepting there, but some of the mean Jews in Thessalonica send some ruffians down to Berea and harass the apostles there. So that's where those congregations, that's how they came about to be, a strong civil resistance and a strong Jewish resistance. And from Berea, Paul eventually is going to get to Greece, to Athens, but he does end up in Corinth, in that little spot right there. And he's there for at least 18 months. He's not driven from Corinth. There is some civil resistance and there is some Jewish resistance, but he's not to the point where he has to leave, and he stays there a good long time, relatively a peaceful work. In fact, the Lord comes to him at night one time and says, "Open your mouth, don't be afraid to speak. I have a lot of people in this city." So God, from the start, had ordained that a great work would take place in Corinth, because it's on that little isthmus, that little piece of land between those two bodies of water. It is a cosmopolitan city of lots of work, lots of jobs. In fact, it's the one time that we hear about Paul working. What does he do for a living in Corinth? Makes tents. Okay, so lots of work, lots of economic opportunities in Corinth, not the poverty of northern Macedonia, not the poverty of Philippi or Thessalonica, Berea, those areas, abundant with people, abundant with trade, abundant with resources. And Paul gets there and begins to preach, and what does God do among the people of Corinth? Saves a bunch of them. Saves a bunch of them. There's some small Jewish resistance, some almost negligible civil resistance. So Paul has this open door in this cosmopolitan, materially prosperous environment, and even the resistance that Paul experiences is not strong enough to have him go, flee to the next city or anything like that. He's there a good long time. So you have these two different circumstances. Paul has just put forward the poor people and them being generous as an example. And who's he talking to in Corinth? Wealthy people. They're rich, okay? They're got good jobs and good trade and good, the trade between these two bodies of water and how they, they're the stopping off point for so many shipping ventures. And so you have this extremely different economic condition. So you got the poor, more rural saints up there in Macedonia, and they are just given what they don't even have to give. And then he's looking at these Corinthians, and he's trying to provoke them. And they are excellent. And I'm going to use that word because it's the word that's used here in the text. They are, I call them the excellent Corinthians. We read in our text, in verse 6, "Accordingly, we urged Titus that as he had started, so he should complete among you this act of," what? "Grace." Remember, he started off, "We want you to know, brothers, about the grace of God that the churches of Macedonia have." And if you don't get this part, the fact that grace is the key point of all of this, you're not going to get what Paul's trying to say. So there's this grace of God that came to Macedonia that evidenced itself in this generous giving of relief. And Paul says in verse 6 that Titus started something and that Paul wants him to finish, he wants him to complete this act of grace among the Corinthians. So Paul is recognizing that this grace has been with the Corinthians. We'll get more into this as we get further into the text and the next messages that lie ahead. But what we're going to find out is that the Corinthians have been setting aside funds for this relief effort for about a year. In 1 Corinthians, in fact, Paul told them at the beginning of each week when you come together, put aside some of what you give to be sent for the poor saints in Jerusalem. So the Corinthians are not just now being introduced to this idea of relief giving. They have been participants in it. In fact, Titus apparently began this work with them, and by most estimations, a year ago. And now Paul is saying, I'm urging Titus to come and finish up so that the grace that the Macedonians have demonstrated in their giving will also be demonstrated with you. And he says, I want to see that you excel in this act of grace. He says that at the bottom of verse 8, I want to see that you excel. That's why I call them the excellent Corinthians. Because Paul uses that, he's going to use that word twice in verse 7. That this grace has been operating in them. And he says, as you excel in everything. I didn't even realize it today until I was making my notes here, that the word excellent is the root word is excel. So when someone excels in something, they are being excellent in it. He says, as you excel in everything, and he gives us a list here. You excel in faith, you excel in speech, you excel in knowledge, you excel in all earnestness, and in our love for you. This is why Bible study is so important. Because without context, we don't really have a clue what he's talking about. But we do have context. We have 1 Corinthians. We have that other letter that he wrote where he addressed some of these very things. And you would have to go to chapters 11 and 12 to read about them, and then including 13, the love chapter in 1 Corinthians. But what you would find is that the Corinthians loved to have lots of whatever thing is going on with them. So if God is with them, moving among them in the gift of tongues, let's say, then the Corinthians all want to speak in tongues. And if God is moving among them in works of miracles, then the Corinthians are all invested in working miracles. So, and Paul addresses that in his second letter, which is called 1 Corinthians. He addresses that they do this, that they, when these graces come to them, they are overflowing in these graces. And he brings it here. When you excel in faith, you demonstrate and work out your faith in supernatural ways. You excel in speech, whether it be in speaking in tongues and interpretations or prophecies or words of wisdom or words of knowledge, gifts of the Spirit. That's what he's referring to here. You excel in knowledge. There are revelations that come to you. You excel in earnestness and in our love for you. And what he is doing is identifying these graces that the Corinthians are all on top of, and then he's bringing relief giving up to match those. The reason it's important for us to get that is because if we don't, we're going to end up as hypocrites. And nobody here, I hope, wants to end up as a hypocrite. So Paul is pointing out to them, when it comes to other evidences of God's power working in you, you blow the doors open. If we were to put it in relevant examples for today, he would say, you are among the most faithful churchgoers. You are among the most vocal in your praises or in your worship. You are the most demonstrable in the acts of service that are the things that culture or tradition say that we should do. So You on the outside, everything looks like you are just an improving and progressing Christian in every area where grace reveals itself. And then Paul is saying, there's a problem if this grace doesn't match that. This relief giving. So it would be like somebody who would appear to be so spiritual and operate on in so many spiritual levels and spiritual gifts, but then find out that they were mainly a gossip. Right? Or in this particular example, mainly to find out that they were greedy or selfish materially. It's like, yeah, they're always there for these other things, these other great apparent graces, but this grace isn't evident in them, and Paul is equating them for us to understand that if we don't have the full range of the graces of God working in our life, we might need to question that we have any of them. Y'all get that? So if the grace of relief giving is not a part of my life, I need to question whether the grace of speaking in tongues or the grace of praising and worship or the grace of church attendance or the grace of any other spiritual activity, I need to question whether those are genuine if I'm missing graces that God obviously grants to the church and grants to individuals in the church. He says, as you excel in everything else, you excel in these things, see that you excel in this act of grace also. This is where introspection comes in. We have to examine our lives. Why is it that I'm able to read my Bible like a fiend, but I'm not? But I lack the grace to give sacrificially or to give to relief ministries that are in need. And honestly, to hopefully bring a little balance to this idea, I suspect that part of our, I don't even want to use the word unwillingness, that maybe some of why we would be weak on the relief giving grace is because the need is oftentimes not sufficiently communicated to us. What I believe is if every week we came in here and we highlighted some need in a dangerous area or some, you know, just like the pastor that we referred to last week in India who'd been beat up and lost his eye, and, you know, and I don't even know if he's still alive or not, but if we were more knowledgeable about those needs, I think it's confirming along with the Word of God. I think the moving of God on us to assist in that relief, I think maybe some obstacles would be taken out of the way if we did that. And maybe we should. And you think about and you pray about that. It's like, well, Brother David, I would participate in relief giving if it's not that I don't want to, but we all need some prods, you know, at some points. And if the, you know, the main thing is if the want to is there. If the want to is there, then we can find ways to remove obstacles that keep the want to from being fulfilled. If the want to isn't there, we got to pray, which is what these messages are about. We've got to pray. So this grace has operated in the Corinthians. He wants Titus to go and bring it to completion. And I only have one question about this. And my question is, why do they need this encouragement? Why do the Corinthians need to be encouraged? The Bible's not going to tell us. But I still think that the question is important to be asked. Because in about two or three verses, and we won't get them today because we're going to wait till after we get back from our trip. In two or three verses, Paul's going to say this. He's going to say, you Corinthians, not only did you begin to do this work but you began to want to do the work a year ago. You're going to find that in verse 10. He's going to go right to that want to. You started giving a year ago, and you began wanting to give a year ago. And if you don't think that that just seals what I've been talking about, then you got to study your Bible more. So why do they need the encouragement now? A year ago, they were first in line to say, yes, let's send some relief. Let's every week put aside something. I wonder if that's where our weekly offering originated, was Paul's direction to the Corinthian church at the beginning of every week, set something aside. It's very possible that's where this tradition came from. But a year ago, you started doing it and you wanted to do it. Why do they have to be encouraged now? They've lost the fire about it. They've cooled about it. We know that there's been sin in the church. We know, you know, Paul has written his severe letter, and now he's written this letter because of division that has been taken place because of some false teachers that have come in and tried to turn people against Paul. We know there's been division. We know there's been sin. In the letter, the first Corinthians, Paul dealt with an immoral relationship between a man and his stepmother. So we know that the work of sin has been taking its toll on the enthusiasm of the Corinthians. And one of the evidences possibly being their getting cool towards their giving, not, as Peggy mentions, the habit of it, not keeping the idea and the mind and the vision about who it is we're helping and why we're helping. And I apologize to you all because I've missed this in my own life, and for no other reason, that's why. And I keep saying at the first of the year, I'm really going to start putting those missionaries' names, posting them every morning so for us to pray about. Because when those names come up, I pray for them more. When I post those missionaries and say, pray for so-and-so and so-and-so who are laboring in Afghanistan or India or whatever place. By the way, those names are the names of people that our mission dollars go to. Okay, those aren't just drawn out of a hat somewhere and say, oh, there's a couple of missionaries, let's pray for them. We are actually materially providing for their support. And when I get those names off the calendar and post them, it provokes a passion of prayer in me that's not there when I don't do it, when I don't have those names. When I pray for the foreign missionaries now, I don't have their names, but I know where they are, and I say, Lord, please watch over whoever's working in that area and keep them today. But it's not the same as when I have Brother Syed or Brother, I'm trying to think of another name, Brother Joseph, some of them just go by their first name. When I don't have those names right in front of me and I know where they are, there's a grace of God that helps me pray for them and here you go. My want to skyrockets. My want to, my joy, that's this where he talked about in verse 3, their extreme poverty have overflowed in a wealth of generosity on their part. When these elements come together in our heart for a grace of God, there is a wealth of fill in the blank. There's a wealth of joy. There's a wealth of passion. There's a wealth of generosity. There is a wealth of time directed to those things when we are obedient and the grace of God is working in us. Yeah, I offer a prayer for the foreign missionaries when I don't have their names in front of me. But when I do have their names in front of me, their prayer, my prayer for them not only helps them, it helps me. I love drawing close to God. I love drawing close. I love to be engaged with my Father in a sense of a relationship that makes me love and want to be with Him more and more. And when I have those missionary names and I begin to pray for them, I'm not ashamed to tell you, oftentimes I begin to weep. I begin to think about my own life, and I think about the riches that I have in my own life, and how they're probably, some of them walking barefoot and getting beat up and their eyes put out, and my prayers just become more and more intense, and the Spirit helps me, and I enjoy God at a higher level. We all really know why they need to be encouraged. The working of sin going on in there, the habit of it just growing old to them, or Paul not being there. There could be lots of reasons. Again, the need for introspection, for a circumspect look at a life. And then the last thing that he says, so you excel in all these other graces, you need to excel in this one as well. And then he nails it. I do not say this as a command. Paul is teaching us that if the want to isn't in you, then you can't do it. But you can ask God to give you the want to. I say this not as a command, but to prove by the earnestness of others, talking about the Macedonians, to prove by the earnestness of the Macedonians, by their example, that your love also is what? What does this text say? Genuine. To prove that your love is genuine. Evidence of love for God, according to 1 John, is love for others. If you want to proclaim that you love God, if you want to proclaim, and you should, if you have a grace of God working in you, relief giving is a grace that proves genuine love. That's what Paul's just said here. Relief giving is a grace, or by grace, proves that saving grace has worked on you. Almost all of 1 John is on this. John says in 1 John, how can you love God whom you have not seen if you don't love your brother whom you have seen? Okay? Evidence of love for God is love for brothers. And he says in 1 John, if you don't have that, you do not know God. Doesn't matter how much you pray, doesn't matter how much you go to church, doesn't matter how much you read your Bible, it doesn't matter how much you go through the routines or traditions of Western Christianity, it doesn't matter how well, how much you excel in any of those things, if those graces aren't evident in your life, you do not know God. I say this not as a command, but to prove. Now, your argument to me could be, well, why do I have to prove it? Why do I have to prove it? Why is Paul, and now me, myself, why are you making the point that if you have saving grace in your life, that it will result in an excelling of all these graces of God, including relief giving. Why do you say that that has to be proved? And the biblical response and answer to that is unanimous in the scriptures, is that a faith that is not evidenced is no faith. A faith that is not evidenced is no faith. James put it in terms of works. Faith without works is what? Dead. Faith without works is dead. If we don't have proof, if we don't demonstrate proof that saving faith by grace is operating in us, we do not know God. And I'm not going to say the only proof, but I am going to say a necessary proof, because Paul is saying it, is relief giving. So to the point that, and it's not the only one. I mean, there are many graces that need to be demonstrated in our life, that they are true and genuine graces of God. But this is just where we are in chapter 8 and chapter 9 of 2 Corinthians for right now, this relief giving. I haven't read much ahead, one or two verses. I don't know everywhere that these two chapters are going to take us. I'm looking forward to them. If the Lord gives us the opportunity to look at them, I don't know where they're going to take us. I feel rich by where they've taken us so far. And again, this, the whole intention, even of Paul's words here, are to teach us to look at our hearts. If I have a want to, how can I put it into action? And if I don't have a want to, what do I need to do before God? Let's stand together.